97.5 FM in Santa Cruz. We're online at kpfa.org.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics.
Up next is Letters and Politics with Mitch Jezrich.
Letters and Politics on today's show.
The ancients thought that aristocracies don't last because the children of aristocrats grow up as pampered beings, or the grandchildren do. And then aristocracy turns into oligarchy, that is, rule by the few only for the few, only concerned with themselves. And when that happens, the people get discontented because they are not being taken care of by the elite that's running society. And in that situation, there emerges from the elite someone who believes that he can take the masses into his protection and ride to power on their anger.
A conversation on how the ancient historians would see our political world today. Our guest is Arthur Eckstein, professor of ancient Rome at the University of Maryland. He joins us next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. President Donald Trump is firing back at his longtime personal attorney and fixer, Michael Cohen, after the release of a recording Cohen secretly made of a conversation between the two men. Trump tweets, "What kind of lawyer would tape a client so sad?" The tape, made 2 months before the 2016 presidential election, captures Trump and Cohen discussing how they would buy the rights to a former Playboy model's account of having an affair with Trump. Lawyers for the two have said the payments ultimately were not made. The tape appears to contradict the Trump campaign's later claim that Trump knew nothing about payments from the National Enquirer's parent company to keep model Karen McDougal's story from becoming public. The publication is headed by a friend of Trump's. It paid McDougal $150,000 for the story of her alleged affair and then sat on it. The tabloid practice is known as catch and kill. Greek rescue and recovery crews are searching through hundreds of charred homes and cars for those still missing after the deadliest wildfires to hit Greece in decades decimated seaside areas near Athens. The death toll stands at 80. There's no official indication of how many people might be missing. A member of the Red Cross spoke to the media after finding bodies in the seaside town of Mati.
Early this morning, we discovered, apart from three other victims further away, this place where, unfortunately, there are 26 people, men, women, and unfortunately, children. We found cars with the keys left in the ignition, the doors open, and first aid supplies left on the seats.
Survivors describe dramatic scenes of people fleeing to beaches and being forced to swim out to sea despite gale force winds and high waves. They were trying to escape choking smoke and flaming pine cones raining down into the water. Rescuers are searching for missing villagers after an auxiliary dam broke in southeastern Laos, flooding the surrounding countryside and killing at least 19 people. Media reports said thousands were waiting to be rescued. The dam gave way after heavy rain. Yosemite National Park is closing to all tourists today. Officials ordered tourists to leave Yosemite as firefighters battle to contain a huge wildfire just to the west. Yosemite Valley will be closed until at least Sunday. The last time the 7.5-mile-long valley was closed because of fire was in 1990. Polls have closed in Pakistan's too close to call parliamentary election. The voting was marred by a suicide bomb attack in Quetta, claimed by the self-styled Islamic State that killed 31 people. Pakistan's Human Rights Commission has said it's one of the dirtiest elections in years, with allegations of vote rigging, intimidation, and the heavy hand of the military. The leading contenders are two right-of-center parties. One is headed by former cricket star Imran Khan. The other is the party of disgraced Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. He's in jail serving 10 years on corruption charges. His younger brother now heads the party. San Francisco has become the first city in the country to call on insurance companies to divest from coal and tar sands industries and to stop insuring such projects and pipelines. The resolution also urges city officials to screen potential insurers to make sure they don't insure or invest in coal. Supervisor Aaron Peskin cited the health and climate change impacts of the two dirty fossil fuels.
We are truly in a race against time as it relates to climate change. The board previously and unanimously supported resolutions to urge the city's pension to divest from fossil fuel and tar sands and coal.
Earlier this year, the Paris City Council passed a similar declaration. San Francisco will host the Global Climate Action Summit this September. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. A grand lesson of history is that no system, empire, or republic, government lasts forever. By definition, history does not tell us when current systems will fall, but it does show us how previous systems fell, and we can glean from them what we will. Today, we're going to look at both the fall of the Roman Republic and then later the empire and compare it to our political times today in U.S. history. For that conversation, very happy to welcome back to our radio station, Arthur Eckstein. Arthur Eckstein is a professor of history and distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland at College Park. He's the author of a number of books, including Moral Vision and the Histories of Polybius. His most recent book is called Bad Moon Rising, How the Weather Underground Beat the FBI and Lost the Revolution. In fact, we had Art Eckstein on to talk about that book just a few weeks ago. And
that's
then we
right.
kept talking
that's
because
right.
you are a professor of the Roman ancient Roman
yeah.
history. We had another conversation, and then I was like, well, let's do
how
this
did this
again.
Happen?
How did this happen? That's exactly how it happened.
It was pure luck, folks.
That's right. Good to see you again. Thank you for
Good.
Coming back.
Good. I'm very glad to be here, Mitch.
I want to quote from an article that you recently wrote that was published in a book called Chaos in the Liberal Order. And your article is called Aristocracy, Oligarchy, and Trump. You say this, quote, "It is clear that Thucydides and Plato, Polybius and Sallust would have been appalled at Donald Trump. But what I have sought to show here is that they would not have been surprised. The Trump phenomenon was familiar to them. They had a vivid awareness of the fragility of free states when the traditional limits on political behavior were broken by a ruthless demagogue emerging from within the existing elite." Tell me more about that.
The ancients believed, ancient political writers believed that the achievement of states where people had rights and where the legitimacy of the government was based on voting, not on the gods or something like that, that those states were fragile. They thought that there were three kinds of states, ruled by one man, would be men too, that's monarchy, which had an evil twin.
All of
tyranny.
These have evil twins,
yes.
right? We'll get to those. So,
yeah.
so monarchy has an evil twin.
Tyranny.
Tyranny.
Aristocracy, which is what we're going to be talking about, ruled by a few, had an evil twin, oligarchy. And democracy, which was also good, had an evil twin, mob rule. In terms of aristocracy, they said an aristocracy is a place where the elite run things pretty much, but they are public-spirited and are concerned with the community.
The word aristocrat, if I recall yeah. correctly, actually means of the best.
Rule by the best.
Yeah.
Right.
Not of the richest.
No.
But of the best.
The most virtuous.
Meaning.
Yeah. Of course, that's how aristocracies always see themselves.
Yes, that's how.
Yeah. So, and I think the American aristocracy saw itself that way. I mean, all those Yaleys who went into the CIA, I mean, all of that, they thought they were being virtuous after World War II. But the ancients thought that aristocracies don't last because the children of aristocrats grow up as pampered beings, or the grandchildren do, and then aristocracy turns into oligarchy, that is, ruled by the few only for the few, only concerned with themselves. And when that happens, the people get discontented because they are not being taken care of by the elite that's running society. And in that situation, there emerges from the elite someone who believes that he can take the masses into his protection and ride to power on their anger. And such a person they call the demagogue. And, you know, Donald Trump fits this perfectly. Or anyway, pretty well. I mean, he's from the elite, and he was a billionaire, or so he says. And yet he says to he says he speaks for the working class, especially the white working class. And it's clear that the white working class, or maybe a lot more than the white working class, were discontented with the establishment. You know, 112 counties that voted for Obama twice voted for Trump.
Amazing.
6 million people who voted for President Obama. Obama voted for Trump. They wanted something other than what they were being offered by the establishment and the established elite. They wanted a newer choice. But Obama wasn't a demagogue, but Trump really is. And so when I say that none of the ancient political writers would have been surprised at this, I think that they were looking at what caused the collapse of free states. And what's interesting about it is, sure, they blame the demagogue, but what they really do is blame the characteristics of the elite. That is, they offer a deep social reason for why these people emerge, which is that the elite has abandoned the interests of the people.
It's fascinating when you explain the shift from an aristocracy originally, meaning I think we have a different kind of idea when we say aristocrat today.
Yeah.
But originally, a shift from aristocracy to oligarchy, and then that sets up the conditions of people being upset about the conditions that leads to the rise of somebody from the aristocratic class, from the upper class.
A renegade aristocrat.
And then, you know, takes on the cloak of the outsider representing the people, the demagogue.
Right.
Of course, I was thinking right there with you, like, oh, my goodness, that sounds just like Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Tell me, in the ancient world, is there a figure like that?
Caesar is a really good example of that. Caesar is a fascinating character, obviously, Gaius Julius Caesar, but he is somebody who, unlike Trump, was a war hero. I mean, he got the equivalent of the Congressional Merit of Medal of Honor when he was 20, saving people's lives. He wasn't a draft dodger. Of course, I was a draft dodger, but I admit it. You know? but he also, in the face of opposition from an established oligarchy, which he thought, that is the Roman Senate, which he thought were only taking care of themselves and were not listening to the complaints of the people, he then rides to power on their support and then arranges to have this huge command where he conquers what's now modern France.
The town called Gaul.
Gaul, yeah.
And Great Britain, too, even though he didn't really
He tried.
Yeah, he got there, but he didn't stay.
Yeah. Which he crossed the Rhine into Germany, too. I mean, he had... There are no limits to his ambitions. And that...
He killed.
Millions.
Responsible for millions.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, some people say it's funny.
No.
You think, not funny, yeah. But I mean, just interesting in the sense of, you know, Hitler, somebody like Hitler is still so fresh in our mind. What happens when you're separated by, 2,000 years?
Yeah, I mean,
and
you
that
think
might be...
That all of those deaths were done with swords and spears and arrows, and face to face, not with machine guns or bombing. I mean,
yeah.
It's really something. The ancients counted up how many people he claimed to have killed, and it was 1,192,000. And
in a world that's probably not nearly as populated.
Oh no,
as
that's right.
The 20th century.
It's a real Holocaust, and. What's even more amazing
it
about
it is a Holocaust.
It is.
It's a European Holocaust.
Yeah, it was, and you can see why people back in Rome, seeing what's going on in Gaul in modern France, might go, "What is this guy going to be like when he comes back?"
Yeah,
and
he's off away for quite some time.
Oh,
right?
he was 8 years.
In a day.
Eight years. Yeah, I mean, he essentially was king of Gaul for 8 years.
What's the situation with the Republic then during this period?
Elections are still going on. He has influence over them. He has allies who help bring friendly public officials to the elections. The Romans have elections every year. That was because they feared kings. So they had very strict term limits for the leading public office. The consulship was 1 year. What Caesar did, and what others were doing in this, what's called the Late Republic, was arrange to have multi-year large commands from the people, voted by the people. And the reason was, when you have rotation in office like that, it's very hard to deal with events far away. I mean, it's going to take somebody 6 months to get where he is. So there was a need to have these multi-year, multi-provincial, large commands in order to deal with the problems of Roman success, which was the empire. If you look at a map, you can see that the empire is huge. But for the Romans, it's five times bigger than it is for us because of transportation primitiveness. So they really, there was a need to have somebody who could be out there a long time. Caesar arranged as champion of the people, which also involved, this was in 59 BC, arranged land redistribution to the poor, things like that. And they
canceled debt for the
canceled,
poor.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an occurrence, isn't it? A reoccurring situation in the late Republic for, say, the last 100 years or so. I mean, you go back to the Gracchi brothers.
Yeah. The problem actually, the large problem in Italy is the growth of large estates, which were caused by the fact that the small farmer who was the backbone of the Roman army, it's one thing if you're fighting in Italy for 6 weeks in the summer, but it's another thing if you have to go to Spain and you're away for 6 years. Then your farm falls into decrepitude because the main laborer is gone in the army, and it was a draft army at that point. So that what you then get is people return, and they've been ruined by defending the state. You know, it's a little bit like all the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans or the National Guard people were called up time after time so that their lives are financially ruined. So they were demanding a new deal, and especially because people who came back sold their farms in order to get out of debt, but then right. They don't have farms, and then they drift into the city so that Rome becomes a city surrounded by slums. The capital of the world becomes surrounded by slums inhabited by the people who made the empire.
And that's just making income. I mean, that's the definition of income inequality. They're selling their farms to the people that already own all the land, and so...
Oh, yes. I mean, the income inequality in the late Republic is astounding. And one of the things Sallust says, you know, he says, houses the size of cities are being built. And that is true. We actually have a map of Rome from that period with lots of little higgly-piggly streets. And then there's somebody's estate in the city, which is the size of five city blocks.
Yeah.
And those people are living, and people can see how what's going on. So the income disparity is terrible. I should say how that was eventually handled was that the young Octavian, who became the Emperor Augustus, settled people, new people, poor people on the land by force in 42, 41, 40 BC. He confiscated private property and gave it to the deserving, actually, veterans who had fought. And, you know, that actually handled the problem. In the first century A.D., Italy is actually a land of small farms. But how it was done was by violence, by saying, okay, this is what's going to happen. Get off the land you have. Here comes the soldier and his friends, and you are through as the owner of this place.
And that's really interesting to me, because Augustus is he takes over. He becomes emperor after Caesar is killed.
Right.
And so we're jumping ahead a little bit. We'll get back to Caesar to complete this story. But that's interesting to me because I think in the ethos of our own culture here, think, well, democracy is always the best, especially for regular people, for poor people. But history would show, and if you have a monarch or let's just say even a dictator, you can have a really bad dictator. But you also find that oftentimes dictators will be friendlier, more compassionate maybe. That might not even be the right term. But more beneficial to poor people than, say, the aristocratic class ever would be.
Augustus certainly was. Octavian certainly was. And Caesar intended to be himself. Let's go back to Caesar, though. The thing is, but his ambitions were viewed as unlimited, and that's what created distrust back in Rome about what he was doing. And I think they were unlimited. To give you two examples, once the Civil War starts, he's 52 years old. He's balding 52-year-old guy with a teenaged mistress who is also the Queen of Egypt. That is Cleopatra. People looked at that and said, what's this? Where is the limits to his appetite? It's not just ambition. It becomes appetite that's involved in it. And so you have writers, political thinkers saying it's appetite that's the problem. And that if you have people with a great deal of power who are oligarchs and only interested in themselves, that appetite shows up first in feasting and food, then in sex, where it's unlimited what they want to do, no restrictions, no limits, and then it's power. So, I mean, you look at Trump, who is supposedly 1 pound short of being officially obese. As for his sexual drive, we've all had to deal with this ad nauseum. And so when people look at that now, they go, this guy has no limits. Right? Republics run on limits, limits on behavior, what you can say, what you can do. People didn't believe that Caesar was going to accept any limits to his power after he'd conquered Gaul. I mean, he became... his private fortune by the end of the Gallic conquest was the size of the Roman treasury. Now, we're not talking about Bill Gates, who's got $100 billion. We're talking about somebody who has $2 trillion. So you can see why people worried about him, that he had no limits.
Yeah, I want to ask you a question. And that is, the Roman Republic, is it democratic? Do people vote?
People vote, but one has to... It's a modulated, complicated thing. People are elected by they're elected by an electoral college where the rich vote first. And there are 193 voting units, and 98 of them belong to the rich. So if the rich all vote for one person... That person automatically has a majority vote of the units, and then there's no need to continue asking other people to be counted.
That's what happened. It just stopped with the aristocrats.
If they were united, the reason I want to make it complex is there were often many candidates running. There could be as many as 6 or 7 candidates running for the consulship, the presidency, in 1 year. And so you could never know how things were actually going to come out. But... it's certainly heavily weighted towards the rich, towards property owners. And the mob, the masses, got one vote, even though they were a majority of the population. Nevertheless, aristocrats and oligarchs had to learn public speaking. And the only reason to do that is because they actually had to convince people to vote for them. And it could happen that very aristocratic people lost.
And that's why oratory is so important.
That's right. That's the mark of a free state. Oratory, the importance of it, is the mark of a free state. It's not a frozen waste. It's very complicated politics. Cicero actually wrote a pamphlet called How to Get Elected, which we have. And it's really complicated. You know, who you have to talk to, who you have to schmooze with, who you have to butter up, all of these things to get elected.
Arthur Eckstein is a professor of ancient history at the University of Maryland, and we are in conversation about how the ancient world would see our current political reality. They wouldn't nearly be as shocked as we are today. Coming up, we'll dive into the original nature of empire. The word empire had a different meaning than how we use it today, and also about the dangers of criminalizing political opponents. I don't know if you saw Attorney General Jeff Sessions yesterday chanting with a bunch of high school students to lock her up, meaning Hillary Clinton. Again, that's the top law enforcement official in this country with high school students. Now, I guess these high school students were a part of some type of a conservative club, but still, nonetheless,
interesting and important to think about. What are we teaching people today? And it may be shocking for us, but again, probably not so shocking for the ancient world. Before we get to all this, I do need a quick moment of your time to ask you for a financial contribution that you can afford, one that is reasonable for you, one that you'll feel good about as you go on to your day. KBFA is in a short summer fun drive in which I get to ask you to support the kind of work that we do here so that we can keep this historic radio station on the air. Now, there are thank you gifts, including our newest Letters and Politics History Pack, which is on tyranny and has a dozen interviews on that topic that you get on a CD. But what I really want to do is to ask you to donate in order just to donate, what I like to call a pure donation, because that gets back to the heart of what this relationship is about, supporting this great American tradition of public broadcasting. And just what we like to call a pure donation is the best way that you can help this radio station. We do need to average about $100 per pledge in order for us to meet our fundraising goals that will help keep this radio program on the air. But that can be a real combination of donations coming from people, ranging from $25 if that's appropriate for you, to $50, $100, $150, even $300, $400, even $1,000. If everyone can do according to their own means, that's how we make this work. So the phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org. I do want to tell you, we did make our $2,000 challenge yesterday, which was great. And we had a few late donations, so we just got over the hump at the very end, but we did get there. And it was a combination of donations that were coming in that were $25 and $50. We got a few $300 pledges. And that's how we make this work, right? Everyone does what they can. And one of those donors is Ruby in San Francisco, who today is using a $500 potential donation to spur you over the next 12 minutes to match that $500. So in other words, this is a matching period. Ruby is put up $500. This is Ruby saying, hey, this is what I can do. I also want to know, because it's conditional, we have to raise an additional $500 in the next 12 minutes. And Ruby's saying, you know, it's an investment. And if I'm going to put $500 in, I want to make sure this radio station is still here next week, next month. So and we all know we can't rely just on one person or just a few people making really large donations to keep this. That's not community radio station. We need those people, but we need everyone. So again, $25, $50, $100, what's reasonable and appropriate for you. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Remember, you can also pledge online, safe and secure. And if you want a thank you gift, you can look at all the things we got there at kpfa.org. Now back to the program. We're in conversation with Arthur Eckstein, professor of history and distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland at College Park, author of a number of books, including Moral Vision and the Histories of Polybius. That's your guy, right, Polybius? We'll talk about him in a moment. His latest book is called Bad Moon Rising, How the Weather Underground Beat the FBI and Lost the Revolution. He's also author of an article that does pertain to the conversation that we're having right now. It's called Aristocracy, Oligarchy, and Trump. The reason I ask if the Roman Republic was democratic, if people voted, and it kind of goes back to a previous question I had, and that is sometimes a dictator or even authoritarian, strong-armed ruler, a monarch, whatever you want to call it, may sometimes be more beneficial towards poor people than a democracy would. And the reason that Caesar was killed, I mean, this is the popular telling of the story anyways, is because he was about to upset the cart, the apple cart for the aristocrats.
Yes, that's true. And one of the things to think about is of the conspirators, half had opposed him in the Civil War and had been pardoned by him. And you would say, and people did say, how ungrateful of them to kill him. To which the answer is, these are people who are used to pardoning people. They're not used to being pardoned. You know, they're used to making it on their own. But the other half of the conspirators, including the leading military person, had supported Caesar in the Civil War. They were people who thought he'd had a case, but they didn't want the Republic destroyed, and Caesar was showing himself to be a person without limits, including having his statue carried with the 12 gods in ceremonies. Or being declared a dictator was actually a constitutional office in Rome.
That's right. Lasted for 6 months.
Lasted for 6 months.
It's like an emergency office, right?
Absolutely.
We need someone in here to call the shots, to deal with a very important situation.
And then you step down.
Yeah.
It's 6 months or the end of the crisis, whichever comes first. And it was a great amount of trust to entrust somebody with the great powers that the dictator had because they're trusting him to step down and not to be seduced by it. But Caesar was made dictator without time limit. At first, he was made dictator for 10 years, not 6 months, and then he was made dictator without time limit, and that was in February of 44, and he's dead the next month. So people worried that he was going to end free politics. And is that politics free and democratic? It is in a way. There are multiple candidates for office, but they're all from the same class.
Yeah.
So you can vote. You can vote for Clinton, or you can vote for Rockefeller, or you can vote for Bush. I mean, this is one of the things that happened in 2016. People did not want to see a Clinton versus Bush, although a Roman would have said, "Of course, that's how things are. That's what you see in every election."
I talked to Paul Cartledge several months ago, classicist on Greece, ancient Greece, and he wrote in a book on democracy that democracies tend to historically favor the aristocrats.
Because they're a known quantity. We know how Roman electoral speeches went, and people had to give speeches in which they would say, "You know me."
And they have the
fellow
time.
Citizens.
They have the time to do it. They have to pursue office. They have the money to do it.
Oh, yeah. Office is unpaid.
Yeah.
Right there, you're limiting who's going to be able to run. It's an honor. It's called an honor. And it's an honor without money attached. Of course, if you go out and slaughter some people, you can get some loot. But it's unpaid. But, I mean, the way that those election speeches ran was, you know me, my father conquered the A's. My grandfather conquered the B's. My great-grandfather conquered the C's. You know what you're getting if you vote for me. And that was a power. Name recognition was a very powerful thing. So every Kennedy and Bush and Clinton and Michelle Obama, too, would have that benefit of name recognition of people who knew what the family had done. It was difficult for people to vote for unknowns.
So they stopped Caesar.
Yes.
Including people who once supported him,
that's
correct?
That's right.
But they couldn't stop the end of the Republic moving into an empire. What does empire even mean in this sense? Because Rome had mostly already expanded.
That's right.
As an imperial force.
Oh, yes. Most of the Roman Empire was conquered under the Republic.
Under the Republic. I mean, I said that before, too, with Paul Cartledge. It's kind of interesting to see how ancient and maybe even modern democratic systems or republics, how quarrelsome they can be. Because same thing with ancient Greece.
They're very
expanded
quarrelsome.
As through – they voted for their imperial expansion. But what does
Athenians
it mean
did.
To become an empire then? It's already owning these territories.
The original meaning of the word imperialism had to do with internal dictatorship. The emperors, starting with Augustus, were called Imperator Caesar, and Imperator just means successful general or victorious general. So into the 19th century, the term imperialism referred to somebody like Napoleon, who was Emperor of the French. He was guilty of imperialism, which did not have to do with expansion. Then in the 1870s, imperialism came to mean people who supported the idea that Queen Victoria should be Empress of India and That's how it gets attached to colonialism and that kind of expansion and begins to be used to mean expansion, especially overseas of any state. Even in 1877, 1878, the person who was the colonial secretary in the British government said, "Imperialism, what is that? This is a new term to me." Hmm. So, but now it does mean unnatural expansion, I guess, and empires, the creation of empires. And I think people want to say, well, empires are bad. But I'm sitting here with Mitch, who seems to be saying, well, you know, empires can be good.
Oh, thanks, Art.
I just thought I'd throw that.
What were you referring
to? It's a controversial
to.
Position.
And again, my point is not that empire is good, but I and again, in the old sense of empire, but I'm just pointing out that there are times, there are conditions where an empire benefited the poor more than perhaps it would under a democratic system. I'm not saying that's what we should go for.
No, yeah. I know you're not. I know you're not.
And just to try to ward off any potential emails that are probably coming my way now, I do recognize terrible dictators ranging from Mussolini and Hitler to, you know, you can go up and down and you know, Franco and find people.
Right. Augustus learned from Caesar not to appear so overtly a dictator. So he took the title First Citizen or Speaker of the House. And he never appeared in the Senate wearing armor. He always wore a toga. He made a point of greeting fellow senators by name and saying, oh, don't get up. On the other hand, under the toga, he was wearing armor to prevent assassination.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the nature of his regime. It's a two-faced regime in which he proclaimed the restoration of the Republic with a guy.
And that was the thing. When we look back now and we see a Republic ending and an empire beginning, no one at that point necessarily saw it that way. It's much easier to look back. I mean, they still had, you saw the Senate.
Yeah.
I guess you saw the tribunes.
Yes. I mean, they're all working. All that stuff is still going on.
All those
Senate meets, elections occur. Yeah.
Exist.
Yeah. Yes. And of course, the people who run for office, and there can be multiple people running for office, they're all friends of Augustus. And he worked very hard to reconcile those who had opposed him, as Caesar had done, who had opposed him in the war. And it's quite amazing. He could have killed them all, but he doesn't. He wants them because he needs an aristocracy to run the empire. He can't do it himself. The Senate, you need generals, you need lawyers, you need diplomats, you need administrators, and those, the way the Romans thought, could only come from the Senate. So he had to deal with them. The emperorship, if you want to use that term, was a schizoid institution. In Rome, he cannot appear as a total dictator. Outside of Rome, all the statues show him wearing armor or naked, which was the other thing. The Greeks liked that. It's called heroic nudity. But I would say about this, the level of distrust that's created by people not accepting limits on their behavior can wreck a republic. The republic depends on, for instance, if you lose the election, you lose the election. That's all that happens. You're not threatened with being imprisoned. When Trump did that to Clinton, threatening her with imprisonment, this was a violation of the limits on behavior that had been established for 250 years, that you don't do that.
Just a quick fundraising update before we return to our conversation with Arthur Eckstein, professor of ancient history at the University of Maryland. I announced 10 minutes ago that Ruby in San Francisco had called in a $500 challenge and that we had 12 minutes to make it. And so far, we have raised $300 towards that $500 challenge, and we have 2 minutes to go until that challenge period is up. So we're asking you for a donation of what you can afford, what is reasonable, what is responsible, and of course, one that you think we are deserving of. We make this through a variety of pledges, $25 pledges helps us. $50 pledges helps us. We also need some folks who are able to afford a $300, a $400, a $500 donation, even a $1,000 donation. If everyone does what they can do according to their own means, we will make this work. This, and I say this, I mean the tradition of public broadcasting. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Pledge online at kpfa.org. My approach to Fundrive is to try to bring conversations to the air like this one today that are first and foremost both educational and interesting, to bring a show that adds, I hope, value to your day. Tomorrow, we are going to explore the scientific advancements in climate studies and genetics, and investigating and showing the new things that they show and how environmental catastrophe played a key role in the collapse of the Roman Empire. And then next week, we have a new show on how radical Christianity and the rise of radical Christianity in the 5th and 6th centuries destroyed the classical world. And then another show on Zora Neale Hurston and her critical work as an anthropologist in saving African-American folklore in the early part of the 20th century. I think these are all important shows, educational shows. I hope they're entertaining shows as well, but we can only do it with your support. We can only have fund drives like this and have this approach if we can make, you know, the minimum of what we need to do, which is our goal, in order for us to make our key contribution to this radio station and helping meet its fund drive goals so that we can keep this historic station on the air. So the phone number again is 1-800-439-5732. Again, less than 2 minutes now to make this $500 challenge opportunity for you to double your donation. 1-800-439-5732, or pledge online, in which we're creating a new system to get out of the mail system altogether, at least the physical paper mail, by going online and pledging at kpfa.org. We now return to our conversation with Arthur Eckstein.
You don't see that as Trump being Trump. Just that's what Trump says. Can't take anything that guy says seriously.
Thucydides, writing 2,500 years ago,
said, he's the Greek historian.
Greek historian said, on the island of Corfu, a debate in the assembly before the people on whether to ally with Athens or not ends with one side winning. The other side then takes the winners to court on various trumped-up charges and fails to convict them. So then those people take their opponents to court and does convict them, and then the opponents assassinate those who had won the victory in court. So you have political debate in the assembly, division, leads to use of the courts, the weaponizing of the courts against your enemies. And Thucydides says this is how things collapse. So when Trump said that, I went, oh, my God. You know, Thucydides would go, I've been here before. I've seen this myself, and here's where it's going to end up.
And Thucydides saw the end of democracy
in Athens. Although it was restored, so
yes, it was
by violence. And those people were heroes. The people who restored them, democracy, were ordinary people who did that. But I think again, the issue becomes distrust, and republics need trust. I know I'm gabbling on, but I can give you two separate sets of information. Since 1992, every American president has been viewed as illegitimately elected by one group or another. Bill Clinton was viewed as illegitimately elected because Ross Perot took 20% of the vote from Bush Sr., who would then have won. Bush Jr. in 2000 was illegitimately elected because of he actually lost the election in popular vote, and then there was the terrible business with Florida. It says, President Obama was considered illegitimately elected by people who thought he'd been born in Kenya and therefore legally could not be president. And Trump was elected, and there are lots of people who say he's illegitimately elected because Clinton won by 3 million popular votes. So we have now had a sequence since 25 years where some large group within the American population views the government as illegitimate, either from the left or from the right. That's very bad for the republic. That creates polarization, creates splits, creates people not only differing politically but beginning to hate each other and feel they're being cheated or somebody is cheating. So that's one fact. How things used to work is this way. Bill Clinton beat Robert Dole for president in 1996. And after the election, Clinton invited Dole to the White House and said, "I know you're interested in the issue of refugees in the Balkans. I want to make you the president's special representative on refugees in the Balkans, and I'll give you one of the Air Force Two, whatever it is." And Dole said, "Okay, I'll do it." He was interviewed on, I hate to say, a station which shall not be named. And the interviewer says, "What are you doing working for Clinton? He beat you." And Dole, who's a representative of the Greatest Generation, the generation that won World War II and then also defeated the Soviet Union, he says to the interviewer, "The President of the United States was my political opponent. He was not my personal enemy. After the election, he asked me to do something for the country. I agreed to do it." What the hell's wrong with you?
What's wrong with you?
And
Bob Dole said that?
Said, yeah. And he's had a bad temper.
Okay.
And that person, the interviewer, is the voice of the future. Yep. There are very few people like Bob Dole anymore. I'm not that I voted for Dole, I can assure you. But this is people who accept limits and cooperation as the essence of the republic.
So here we are in this situation right now, and I think it's pretty remarkable, and I'm curious if you see parallels at any time in the ancient world where you have what seems like government entities going after each other. Maybe this is related to what you were talking about with Corsica and the threatening or even the imprisoning of your political opponents. But,
right.
You know, you see what's happening in the House Intelligence Committee against the FBI, the Trump against the FBI, but you see how Democrats are responding, you see how the FBI is responding. And almost, I'm getting the sense, not that these were perfect. I mean, I was on Capitol Hill 10 years ago covering congressional hearings almost every day, but I've never seen what really seems like, and maybe we got this during the McCarthy era, but just the pure weaponization of these entities.
I agree, Mitch. I've never seen anything like this either. Even in 1968, or maybe in 1968, but not since 1968-69, it is a distrust in the institutions. And it means the reason for that distrust of certainly being weaponized by Trump is that those institutions are not responding quickly enough to the needs of the population as the population sees it. And the Senate in Rome, there used to be no alternative to the Senate. So people went along with them being clumsy and slow. Then people began saying, well, the Greeks have alternatives to this kind of republic. One of them is somebody who's given a lot of power to get things done quickly. And after 133, after the Gracchi, who are saying, we can have land reform. We don't have to wait for the Senate to vote on it, because they never will, because they're large landowners. They don't want reform. I, the tribune, Tiberius Gracchus, will offer you land, state-owned land, so that you can get back on the countryside and have small farms again. Once that happens, once there's an alternative, then people are looking at alternatives to senatorial rule. That undermines the Senate, which had, up to then, had such enormous prestige that people listened to it. But now people are saying, well, who are those guys in the Senate? They're just rich guys who don't care about us. So people
but
look
but
at
so with the Gracchi, though, then that's how we end up getting the Tribune of the Plebs.
Right.
And we say tribunes, interesting, the word a newspaper will call itself a tribune.
Well,
the,
you know what their position
Oakland,
is.
The Oakland, we have a tribune building still, unfortunately doesn't have a paper.
Yeah.
But that said, tribune was to be sort of the protector, the voice of the people.
He was the protector
of the people. It doesn't sound like those things are bad things.
They weren't. No, I mean, the issue, I mean, again, if you go back to what the ancient political thinker says, demagogues don't come out of nowhere. They come out of specific social economic situations in which the people are not being cared for by the elite. And that's when you get a renegade from the elite who claims to speak for the people, who's usually only after himself, but they can do very good things as well, because if they get power, they're exercising it. People, the ancient writers would say, we know who this guy is. We know who Trump is. We've seen him before.
Arthur Eckstein, and I've enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mitch.
Arthur Eckstein has been our guest, professor of history and distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland at College Park. He is a professor of history specifically on the ancient Roman world, author of a number of books. His latest book, which is not about ancient Rome, is called Bad Moon Rising, How the Weather Underground Beat the FBI and Lost the Revolution. And I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did, because I did enjoy that conversation. This is Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. My friends, we did make that $500 challenge that Ruby in San Francisco called in previously. And so I want to thank you for that. I want to thank the folks like Sandra in Novato and Skip in San Francisco, Susan in Berkeley, and also Bruce in Fresno for helping us get there. A few people also donated online. Now, we just got over that part, and we're not where we need to be for the end of this hour, though, for our total fundraising goal. So if you've been listening to this conversation, if you've been enjoying this conversation, if you have found that this conversation was educational, that brought something to enlighten your day, something to make you think about, something that you may want to investigate furthermore, or something that just helped pass the hour, pass the day, maybe even perhaps deepen the day, I hope you'll go to your phones right now and make a contribution of, again, whatever you can afford. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and also pledge online at kpfa.org. Again, we're asking for a to donate, right? Because that gets back to the heart of what this relationship of public broadcasting is all about. And that is the best way that you can help KPFA and make sure that we stay on the radio station. We do have thank you gifts. You can always go online to get them at kpfa.org. If you're calling in and you want a thank you gift through the phone, we are offering our very latest Letters in Politics history pack, which is on tyranny, a dozen interviews related to that topic, including all the interviews. These are all brand new interviews that you're going to hear this week and next week. So the phone number, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org. And as I say this, I am given another note. What happens is people hear this and they want to get on it, and people care about this radio station and they want to do what they can to make this radio station work. And so when they hear these challenges go out, they're like, well, I can do that. And we have another one. This one's from Clive in Petaluma, Jose in Concord, and Deb in Fairfax, who together are putting up $1,000 for us to make here in our final 7 minutes. If we could do that, my friends, we make the goal for today. And that's really important, because that's what gives us the ability. That's what gives us the sort of flexibility. That's what gives us the cover, really, to be able to do this without, you know, a movie or a speech. And those things are obviously important. But we like our philosophy here, as I said before, we like to ask you for a pure donation, because, again, to me, that's what this radio station is really about. So let's bring something to air that we do that we hope is worth your time and something that you would want to support in of itself. So there's $1,000 right now on the table. And if we can meet this $1,000, we did make that $500 challenge. So we're now just a little over $1,000 towards our overall goal, which is $3,000. There's now $1,000 on the table. If we can raise $1,000 before the top of the hour, that would be $2,000 matched with what we've already raised, and we make the goal.
So the phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. And I want to tell you, for this drive, I am locked into this format. We got the go-ahead, in fact, from our management. And that's great, but not so great if we are unable to make these goals, which aren't astronomical goals. They're bare minimum goals. We need to be able to raise on average. Some days you're going to get a little over, some days a little under. But at least on average, Letters in Politics has to raise $3,000 to really justify its existence here at 10 a.m. Monday through Thursday. And that's what that comes down to. So we are locked in to this format, and I'm hoping you will help us make it work by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. And it's important because KPFA is a radio station that has this, what I like to call, a fun drive to fun drive type of an existence, right? It's very much like having a paycheck to paycheck existence. And you know what happens when that paycheck isn't what you thought it would be or what it was in the past, and suddenly you can't make rent, or perhaps you can't make the credit card bills, or perhaps you can't pay the electrical bill, or, you know, whatever it may be. Child support. We have all kinds of obligations on us. And I respect that if you're one of those people that have all those obligations on you and you aren't able to make that donation right now, let me say to you, we're glad you're there, because there's nothing worse than a lonely radio broadcaster. And I look forward to the day that you can make that contribution. And if you are that person that can make that contribution, I really want to stress to you, we need you to stand up. And if you're somebody, because so far, I'm looking at what we have so far today. We have $50 pledges and $100 pledges. In order for us to make this, we're going to need a few $300 pledges or $400 pledges. If this is something that's easy for you to do, you know, if you can make a $500 donation or even a $1,000 donation, don't even have to really look at your latest bank statement to know whether or not you can cover that. It's because of you as well that we make this work. Again, everyone doing what they can according to their own means. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org. Got our first donation towards this $1,000 challenge. We're going to have to pick it up. But Sherry Gendelman, thank you so much for that. Of course, you can hear Sherry Gendelman. She is a KPFA staffer. She volunteers her times on Sundays and probably other times as well, where you can hear her great show that I like listening, waking up to in the morning, which is the classical musical program on piano on Sunday morning. So Sherry, thank you for that. We're now $50 towards that $1,000 challenge. $950 to go. 3 minutes to make it. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Remember, you can also pledge online at kpfa.org. We're now $65 towards that $1,000 challenge. 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org. And I see this hour. How do I see Letters in Politics? Well, I see this hour as in the hour itself, the literal hour that we are on the air. It's like a stage where we tell stories through the art of conversation. And like every stage, it's a place where we can explore our world, where we can explore our history, our predicaments, our human condition. And that's what I'm asking you to support to keep here. This is our way of passing around the hat and asking people to contribute what they can in order to keep this program on the air. But of course, much more than just this program, everything that this radio station does, it's incredible. We have training programs. We have the KPFA News Department program. That's a program that I came in to this radio station many years ago. Many others have as well. And this is a program that teaches you everything you need to know about broadcast journalism. Started many careers. Also starting many careers is the KPFA Apprenticeship Program. This is this program that does a tremendous job in bringing a diverse array of people into the radio station from around the Bay Area and teaching them everything they need to know about broadcasting. They're the ones that keep this place running. But it's your donation that keeps that running, that keeps that possible, that we have the events that Bob Baldock and Ken Preston put on, in which we have great authors and intellectuals and activists from around the world come to our very own Bay Area and to converse with us. That's what your donation goes to as well. Folks, we're way behind. So I'm really asking you, if you're one of those people that can make a large donation, I'm hoping you'll do so by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. Still, I'm very thankful to everyone who has pledged this hour, and I thank you, and stay tuned for Mingle.